And good morning. In for Elizabeth Harrison in Providence, I'm Chuck Henman. Unsettled weather continues today. Chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, according to the National Weather Service. Hopefully not as unsettled as yesterday. The Labor Day holiday was more than a washout for some 60 residents of a Cranston apartment complex on Oaklawn Avenue. Fire officials say a flash flood came during a heavy downpour at the Dean Estates complex yesterday, and now the cleanup. According to the Providence Journal, fire officials say the floodwater yesterday was contaminated with sewage, and one resident says he was told it could be a month or so before he could come home. No serious injuries were reported in yesterday's flooding. The Rhode Island State Council on the Arts is taking submissions from local artists for some gallery space at TF Green and Block Island airports. Rhode Island Public Radio's Catherine Welch has more.
An airport might not be the first venue that comes to mind when one thinks of an art gallery, but both the Block Island Airport and TF Green have set aside space to highlight the work of Rhode Island artists. Now, the state's Arts Council is looking for work to fill those spaces next year. Riska says displaying your work at an airport means it's exposed to a constantly changing audience passing through the terminals. Riska is looking for work in all media and says there's room on large walls and open spaces for bigger pieces. To qualify, artists must be Rhode Island residents. The deadline is October 1st. Catherine Welch, Rhode Island Public Radio.
A new study on climate change has a prediction that sounds hopeful at first. The study, published today in the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, says that man-made global warming may further lessen the likelihood of the freak atmospheric steering currents that last year pushed Superstorm Sandy almost due west into New Jersey. That hurricane path stood out as a once-in-700-years occurrence and will probably now become even less likely in the future, according to the study. However, the study's authors also add a caveat. Other variables such as sea level rise and stronger storms will worsen with global warming and thus outweigh the changes in steering currents predicted by the computer models. Jury selection is planned to start tomorrow and testimony next week in the trial of the third suspect who's charged in a fatal shooting outside a Woonsocket bank in 2010. The suspect, Jose Santiago, allegedly drove the getaway car after gas station manager David Main was shot and killed in the robbery. Santiago's charged with robbery, conspiracy, and using a firearm in a crime of violence. Two other suspects have pleaded guilty, including Jason Plew. His case became a custody battle between the feds and Rhode Island over the issue of capital punishment. Plew plea bargained with federal authorities to avoid the death penalty.
We're also joined by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning.
Senator, we've all watched this situation in Syria where tens of thousands have been killed with conventional weapons even before the use of chemical gas. No one likes seeing that kind of violence, of course. And at the same time, the U.S. has been reluctant to arm the opposition because of concerns to al-Qaeda or jihadist groups. How does the U.S. reconcile those two competing concerns?
It's a very difficult, complex situation. You have sectarian violence. You have a government, Assad government, which has delegitimized itself in the eyes of the world as well as its own people. But you have rebel factions that are composed and part of jihadists and part of more moderate elements. All of this is creating an incredibly complicated situation on the ground. We have, and I think properly, refrained from any direct involvement in the ground operations. With this latest series of attacks with chemical weapons, it has raised the situation dramatically. But we should be very reluctant to enter into the ground operations in Syria. It's very complicated.
Let's go to Scott.
I mean, just weeks ago, the Egyptian security forces slaughtered hundreds of Egyptians in the street, and their only crime was to protest a military coup that overthrew a democratically elected government. And yeah, we didn't do anything. What's the difference?
The difference might just be, one, Egypt has been a country that has been much more supportive of international norms than Syria. They have maintained a peace treaty with the State of Israel for decades, providing stability for the region. They allow transit of ships, not just warships, but commercial vessels. And they also have been helping us in terms of providing intelligence for our fight against jihadist elements. Syria, on the other hand, has been
a rogue state.
A rogue state, exactly. And that might be the difference, but in terms of looking at the violence being perpetrated by an armed force against its people, the difference is very little.
What's the legal basis for military action here? Neither China nor Russia is likely to approve a UN resolution. So just what's our legal basis?
The legal basis would be very clear if we could get a UN resolution. But as you rightly point out, China and Russia will unlikely veto such a resolution. The next step would be to assemble a coalition, as we did with respect to both Libya and with respect to Bosnia in the late 1990s, where, in that case, in Bosnia, it was NATO. But it was the United States and a strong group of nations across the globe who united to say they could not allow the depredations that were going on with respect to the Bosnian people by that government to persist. Then, of course, within the United States, there are issues the president has to consider very seriously about his constitutional role, the War Powers Act. All of those have to be answered before he takes action.
It wasn't that long ago when the so-called Arab Spring raised hopes for a more stable, more democratic Middle East. Things have obviously gotten more bumpy since then. How do you see the long-term outlook for a more stable Middle East?
I think we're in for a period of great instability. And I think the real factor was the initial invasion in Iraq, which destroyed a fairly stable arrangement between Sunnis and Shias in the region.
And now there's sectarian violence there every day, it looks like.
It's every day in Iraq. It's Sunni, Shia, Kurd. Syria is a sectarian battleground. It's Shia, Sunni, and Kurd. You're seeing these ramifications across the region, and it flows quite directly from our operations to open up and to eliminate Saddam. Now, he was, again, a despicable dictator. You couple that with the ability of individuals to mobilize through social networks, and you also couple that with regimes that have not produced economic growth for their people for years, the frustration, the ability to communicate, all that drove the Egyptians to Tahrir Square, the Tunisians, all of that. But now what we're seeing is after these movements, the inability in many cases to govern, to effectively govern. So I don't think you're going to see a dissipation of these sectarian fights for a long time. These are not strictly political battles. These are not strictly economic issues where if one side gets the economic edge that they're satisfied and the other side might relent, say have a little left or something. These are deeply theological, ideological battles, and they last a long time.
I'd like to switch gears to talk a little bit about financial regulation. It was 3 years ago when the Congress passed the Dodd-Frank bill meant to reel in and prevent the kind of collapse on Wall Street that preceded the Great Recession. Dodd-Frank has not been implemented. Does that show that the financial industry can successfully thwart and ward off attempts to reel it in?
It has not been fully implemented. Many reasons are because of the protest of the banking industry in terms of the courts, going to the Court of Appeals in Washington and frustrating rules and regulations constantly. But there are many aspects of the law that have already produced some beneficial results. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is up and running. We finally got Dick Cordray confirmed. They are, for the first time, regulating the shadow banking system, those state licensed mortgage companies, those state licensed payday lenders. That is going to be a huge improvement for consumers across the country. The Federal Reserve and the other agencies have taken a much more aggressive approach to regulating the industry. They've raised capital significantly. One of the problems is that we had institutions that had too little capital for the risk they were running. Now the capital has been increased. You've got a much more aggressive Securities and Exchange Commission. There have been several very high-profile trials with respect to insider trading. In addition, they are beginning to look very, very seriously at issues such as the London Whale with respect to J.P. Morgan, where they have, together with the Department of Justice, are trying to indict and convict these individuals who are involved. It's a much different regulatory climate. The regulators are paying attention. And one of the problems, and it started, frankly, in the late 90s, but it really reached a crescendo under President Bush is this lax regulation of the Greenspan view that, you know, no regulator can be smarter than the market. Well, we found out sometimes the market makes huge mistakes.
Or the market's rigged.
Well, exactly right. The market is so opaque that the information advantage that somebody has can be manipulated to their benefit. And that's one of the things that we're trying to roll out through Dodd-Frank. And this is where the slow pace because of court challenges. For example, in terms of the derivatives, we have tried to get them onto a central clearing platform and ultimately a trading platform so that the market set the price, not somebody sitting in an office who has all the information selling to somebody who has no information.
Looking at the fall, looming are a couple of really big issues. First of all, there's this debt ceiling. Should the president negotiate the budget, or should he just say to Republicans, unless you raise that debt ceiling, we're not talking?
My sense is he should take the latter course, which would be to say we have to raise the debt ceiling.
Right.
You've demonstrated in August of 2011 that a heated debate and serious and really, that's the first time there was a serious movement to defund the government, to default on our obligations, causes huge economic havoc. We lost jobs. We were downgraded by the financial rating agencies. We're in a situation that we know, and the American people know now, doesn't help our economy grow. And so the president, I think, should insist on that and then also say, and we also understand we have to negotiate a budget to keep the government operating and to keep programs funded at reasonable levels.
Political guru Nate Silver recently called the outlook for Democrats to maintain control of the Senate next year a toss-up. Do you believe that Democrats will be able to maintain control of the chamber?
I believe we will, but I also believe that every election cycle is a toss-up. You know, it is tough. There are so many different variables. A lot depends upon where we are, not just today, but 6 months or a year from now in terms of the economy, in terms of confidence of the American public, consumer confidence, in terms of these foreign episodes. You know, again, 3 weeks ago, we were all saying, my God, the biggest problem is Egypt. And now suddenly that's page five and the front page is Syria and use of chemical weapons.
What would it mean for Rhode Island if Republicans did gain control of the Senate on top of controlling the House?
It would not be helpful because they would propose budgets, as they have in the House, which are draconian. The House budget under Paul Ryan's leadership basically makes huge cuts in discretionary spending. That's huge cuts to health care programs like Medicaid, huge cuts to Head Start programs, huge cuts to highway infrastructure programs that are critical to the vitality of the state and necessary for employment growth. And then they shift a lot of money into defense. There has to be a better and a balanced approach, and that's the approach the Senate has taken under Democratic leadership. One of the testimonies to this is the House Republicans brought their transportation bill to the floor. They couldn't even pass it because they didn't want to be on record as cutting off highway funding to their states.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Senator Jack Reed.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Scott.